And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's start our weekly news review now with our friends from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We have reporter Joe Ingles. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
And we have reporter Andy Chow. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Michael.
So, Joe, we had some late-breaking news. The federal judge ordering some reopening of ballot drop boxes here, allowing some staff drop boxes at remote sites. This was a big deal. We just had Secretary of State Frank LaRose on not that long ago, and he stood by his position, one drop box per county. So this changes things.
Yeah, this story kind of changes by the minute, but it seems like what happened was earlier this week, a federal court ruled, and they made this ruling that we all kind of said, huh, that doesn't make sense, because they kept referred to the being able to have auxiliary remote sites for drop boxes. And we're like, that's not in the directive. But anyway, that was the order. He dismissed this lawsuit that was brought against Secretary of State LaRose over adding drop boxes. And then last night, it was like, lo and behold, he's reopened the case and he says, yes, you can have drop boxes. But Secretary of State LaRose is appealing the order. So, you know, stay tuned.
So it's not over yet.
It's not over yet.
Well, can you give us an idea of, for people who have never voted via Dropbox before, what are we looking for here? What are these things?
Well, usually they're a pull-up thing where you can pull into a parking lot, and it looks like a mailbox, actually. It's a mailbox kind of thing, and you drop your ballots in it. And it's designed to allow people to directly get their ballot to the Board of Elections without having to put it in the mail. And right now, that's a big deal because there are questions as to whether these recent cutbacks that they've had with the mail service, whether that will affect the timeliness of the mail service. So a lot of people who haven't used drop boxes in the past are sitting there thinking, I might want to use one of those. The problem is, in Cincinnati, your drop box is in the middle of Hamilton. Well, while that's in the middle of Hamilton County, it's far away for people who are living on the edges of the county. And those people, if they don't have a car, I'm told it takes them an hour to an hour and a half to get to the drop box one way on a bus. So, I mean, that's the problem you're dealing with. So some of these larger cities have said, hey, we would like to have more drop boxes in more locations to make it more convenient for voters. And that's the problem, because Secretary of State LaRose does not want to allow that. He wants the drop boxes only at the boards of elections.
And so,
now, this ruling says, though, that they can go ahead and put them out. But then, like I said, it's being appealed, so we don't know how long that'll stand.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask. My apologies for talking over you, Joe. But if the Secretary of State is appealing this, there's got to be a sense of urgency in the court system to deal with this in the election cycle. Is there any possibility that this goes beyond election season, as I've heard it referred to now?
Oh, yeah, there's always a possibility it goes beyond election season. But, they have ruled fairly quickly for courts on these issues. But, right now, if they go out and if Hamilton County puts up a drop box tomorrow, it will stand until a court weighs in. And if the court doesn't weigh in till the end of next week, then it's, and says, you can't do that, then it will stand for a week, or maybe the court won't weigh in, or maybe the court will weigh in and say, hey, we agree with the lower court and those drop boxes are okay. So we don't know where this stands at this point. It's up to the counties to decide, do they want to go ahead and put a drop box in and have it for maybe, a short period of time.
And we saw this week, as early voting got underway in Ohio, Joe, there is some significant interest in voting in this election cycle. So what did we see as early voting started? Big crowds?
Oh, big crowds. I went to the Franklin County Board of Elections the first day that it opened for early voting. And people, some people were there at 4 a.m. 4 a.m. This is the new Black Friday, Michael. The new Black Friday. I'm telling you. It's no TV set or anything, but you get a ballot at the end of it. So anyway, they were waiting in line for an hour or more, and they would get in there and they'd vote. And they were all, you think maybe you get people who are crabby or, complaining about the line. Nope. it was like a party in that line. People were talking. They seemed to be upbeat. They seemed to be having fun. There were no incidents. And as of the first couple of hours when I talked with the spokesperson for the Franklin County Early Vote Center, he said they hadn't had any issues with masks either. Of the thousands of people who went through there, they didn't have anyone complaining about wearing a mask, which is kind of interesting.
That is very interesting. And you say Black Friday, we're talking about election season. I guess all we need now are election carols. And let's see if our friend Andy Chow has any off the top of his head to sing for us. Andy, I know you're exploring some absentee ballot situations because some people will be voting this way. And there are some tips that you might want to offer. If you want to sing these tips, go right ahead.
Well, I was thinking whatever the opposite of a silent night would be, that would be what election night is probably going to be like.
Oh, okay.
there are a lot of tips because for many, many people around Ohio, this seems to be maybe their first time that they've requested a mail-in absentee ballot. We're seeing a record number of requests coming in around the state. And so we've talked to different voter rights advocates and different elections officials about what should people know about filling out these paper mail-in ballots that they've never filled out before. One of the big things that might seem pretty obvious, but maybe just the most important thing, is just to read through all the instructions. I know that for a lot of counties, they not only send out the ballot, but they send out different pamphlets really detailing the instructions of how this goes. And each county might have just a little bit of a different instruction or a little bit of a different direction. One of the big things is that there are these, there's this term known as a naked ballot. And actually there's this PSA video that's gone viral with these celebrities talking about this issue with no shirts on. So there's kind of like this big rallying cry to get people to understand what this is all about. In Ohio, you have two envelopes that you're supposed to put your ballot in. The first envelope is an identifying envelope that requires you to put your information so the Board of Elections can verify that it is, in fact, you turning in your ballot, just another safeguard to make sure that there's no sort of fraud going on. You put your ballot into that envelope, and then you put that envelope into the secret envelope, the one that protects your information. And your ballot needs to go into both of those envelopes.
It's just a couple of steps you have to take, but have there been any complaints about difficulty, or does it seem rather easy for folks?
Well, it seems rather easy at this point. I think we're going to start seeing in the next few days or maybe in the next few weeks, keeping our ear out for any sort of problems. I know another thing is that most elections officials are saying really make sure that you're using an ink pen, a black ink pen. Some people might think that it's okay to fill it out with pencil, but they say that a black ink pen is the best way to go. So it's these really little things that people maybe not really think about, but because this is new to them and they want to make sure that they get it right. The other really big thing that groups are saying is just to do all of this early. If you have your ballot, fill it out right now and turn it in. That way, if there is any problem, an elections official will reach out to you and help you find a way to fix that problem.
And Joe, I understand that some voters are receiving damaged ballots. It's not a huge deal. This can be addressed.
Yeah, Andy's actually done more of the reporting on that, but that's a Franklin County issue. The damaged ballots you're talking about, the damaged ballots is there's a little window on the envelope, and that window apparently catches, we don't know exactly how they get damaged, but the theory is maybe they get damaged in the sorting equipment, or they might get damaged, you know, by catching on other pieces of mail or something. But people have gotten their outside envelopes on their ballots completely ripped up by the time they get to them. And then they're like, well, you know, they open it up and the ballot inside is usually okay. If they get a ballot that's got damage on it, on the envelope, and it bothers the ballot inside, it affects it in any way, you just call your local Board of Elections. They will reissue the ballot. It's not a big deal. But that window seems to be a problem, and somehow catching on things to tear the envelope pretty easily.
And we're talking with Joe Ingles and Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Obviously, we're voting in these different ways this election season because of COVID-19. So let's get the latest on COVID-19 in Ohio. Andy, obviously the most famous COVID patient in America right now is none other than the president of the United States, Donald Trump. And what did the governor have to say about Trump's diagnosis and what lessons might be taken and whether he agrees with some of the strange messages coming from the White House after that diagnosis? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the big thing that we're hearing from Governor Mike DeWine when it comes to the president's positive COVID-19 test is that DeWine says this really shines a spotlight on the importance of wearing a mask and observing distance. Well, as we know with White House protocol, whenever the president goes to do something, they do frequent testing where anybody who's about to see the president gets this rapid antigen test. And then we see these large events. We see that infamous Rose Garden event where he announced the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett as the nominee for his selection for the U.S. Supreme Court, where you see all these people gathered around in close proximity, not wearing a mask. And the reason for that would be that the White House says, well, they were all tested. And Governor DeWine saying, it doesn't matter. Nothing takes the place of wearing a mask and keeping your distance. We know this through all the medical experts who have talked about COVID-19, and so the governor has talked about how even with frequent testing, the best thing to do, wear a mask, stay apart, stay outside, avoid large groups.
And one message that came from the president, though, was, you know, don't let it dominate your life. He's been through it now, and it seemed to downplay it a little bit, which he had been accused of doing since this whole thing started. But now that he's experienced it, like, don't let it dominate your life. The governor agreed with that?
Well, the governor, in keeping with kind of what he's been doing this whole year, trying to kind of play both sides to it, walking this thin line, he said that he agreed with the president that it shouldn't dominate our lives, but he said we should still approach things with caution and do the things that we need to do in order to mitigate the spread of the virus. And in a question that he was answering yesterday during his daily press briefing, He basically was a little more blunt about the idea of really the things that we're asked to do, we can still do most of the things we want to do. We just have to do it while wearing a mask and staying 6 feet away from somebody instead of maybe 2 feet away from somebody. And so he was sort of pushing this message that the things that we want to do, we can still do just with masks and distance. But with the numbers that we're seeing in Ohio, we're constantly seeing these cases rise up again. We saw another large amount of new cases. We're seeing hospital admissions go up. So it does seem like Ohio is maybe on this verge of seeing a bigger increase in cases here.
And Joe, that is what the governor said yesterday, that he's got some concern because the situation related to COVID-19 in Ohio is worse.
Yeah. He says the numbers have gone up since September. And the number of people being admitted to the hospital is concerning right now. And we're going into winter when more people are going to be spending time indoors where there won't be the ventilation. And that's going to be a problem with COVID-19. So he's very concerned about that. He's stressing, you know, wear a mask. And I think, you know, his big concern is, you know, it's real easy when you listen to the president to think, if I get sick, I can just go get treatment and I'll be okay, because, you know, that seems to be what's happened with him. And Governor DeWine wants to make sure that people know that this is a big deal. Don't take it lightly, and wear a mask, social distance, do all the things you need to do to prevent it on the prevention side so you don't have to deal with it by going to the hospital and doing experimental treatments and all that.
In addition to the health concerns that we all have, obviously the economic impact still lingers both for the general economy, businesses and that sort of thing, and us as individuals, all impacted by this in some way or another. And it looks like talks in Washington have kind of stalled as it relates to a new relief package like the CARES Act that was adopted earlier this year. Andy, both U.S. senators from Ohio are saying something needs to happen, right?
Yeah, Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown says that he wants to see movement on a new stimulus package and for new aid coming into small businesses and for the unemployed. And actually, we're seeing that Republican U.S. Senator Rob Portman is calling for the same things. He's calling for a more targeted paycheck protection plan that we saw earlier this year to help small businesses be able to keep their be able to maintain their staff. And then we're also hearing an extension of the compensation, the extra compensation that people who are unemployed were getting. What seems to be the issue here is that the president at the beginning of the week said that he was pulling all of his staffers out of negotiations. He didn't want to talk about a new stimulus package until after the election. On the and this is through Twitter, on the same day, he then said that, well, maybe he would want to do something if it were a standalone stimulus check or this or that. And so it does seem to be kind of mixed signals coming from the White House on where the Senate and the House might go from here. But like you mentioned, there's a lot of people who are still struggling and wondering what's going to happen from Washington to maybe help them.
Before I let you all run, something strange happened in Michigan where a terrorism plot was thwarted that was targeting the governor there, Gretchen Whitmer. And Joe, I'm wondering what Governor Mike DeWine had to say about this, whether there's any concern about his roles. He's certainly been the target of some heated political rhetoric, not just from not just from the public, members of the public, but even elected officials. And we've seen what's happened with, you know, the position of public health director in the state, that's been scary at times to hold that position. What has the governor said about what happened to his colleague in Michigan and whether any extra precautions are being taken here?
Well, of course, he immediately condemned the action and he called it horrific. And he said that it should never happen to anyone. He said that he couldn't really talk about security plans in Ohio. But he did say that it didn't get to that level. The problems with Amy Acton, our former Ohio Department of Health director, and the problems that the governors had with groups that oppose him. They have never really risen to that level. I asked him about the concern over poll workers because, you know, we have poll workers who are going to have to deal with all kinds of new issues on Election Day that they haven't dealt with before. We've got COVID. And then there's a possibility that something could happen at polls. And so I asked him about that, and he said that they are talking, the security folks, the state leaders are talking behind the scenes to see where they might go with that, and that local boards of elections can always call their local police in if they need to do that. So, but still at this point, we're not really sure on the plan with polling places.
Our thanks to Joe Ingles and Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Always a pleasure to have you all. I think we heard Andy disconnect there accidentally. That's okay. We are saying goodbye. Joe, thank you for your help today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And if you are a voter in Kentucky, we want to remind you that today is the last day to request a mail-in ballot. You have until 11:59 Friday evening to do that. You can go to govoteky.com for that information if that is something that you are interested in. Coming up next, we talk with Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman, who goes back to his old part of town where he grew up, the west side of Cincinnati, and he explores the politics of that area ahead of the election. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman recently visited his old stomping ground on the west side of town, and he wrote about it in the context of politics. And he joins us live via Zoom now. Scott, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Michael, thanks for having me.
I'm always glad to have you. It's always too long between visits from you. I want to read a little bit of what you wrote in this post. Quote, I found mostly Trump supporters who supported the president not for any particular issue, but based on their gut feeling. They like the president, their family likes the president, and their friends and neighbors like the president. And I thought of all the words you offered us in this very interesting story you wrote, that stood out the most to me because that's a lot similar to the way the president governs, right? I mean, he goes to his gut and his strong supporters go to his gut. Talk about your visit to the West Side and what you found of Trump supporters there.
And I agree with you. I was expecting to hear And I got these comments in my story too. I was expecting to hear more about like issues like abortion or immigration or things like this as why like they, you know, they vote the way they do. But it was more the people I talked to relate to the president on a very personal level. They feel they like just his style. One person said they liked his arrogance. And regardless of the daily controversies that come out of the White House, it really doesn't move the needle for a lot of people in these conservative areas. Their friends love President Trump. They love President Trump. And that's just how it is.
And certainly the west side of town is not alone in that. In our metro area, there are big pockets of Trump support across the region, as well as support for Biden in various pockets of the metro. But I do want to note, you know, as you just said, some of these, we might call them scandals or issues or strange positions that come out of the White House do not sway these voters. They stay pretty well committed. You did write a little bit. You touched on the QAnon conspiracy theory, which we did a segment about not that long ago. It's this weird belief about, as you write it, a loosely connected network of discredited and baseless conspiracy theories accusing Democrats and Hollywood elites of being in a cabal of pedophiles and human traffickers. One of the people you interviewed said that they don't necessarily buy into that conspiracy, but they also don't seem to mind much about factual reporting, like Bob Woodward's revelations in his books, Trump's back and forth on whether he'd accept the election results. What is it about this president that they find so much support for in their gut?
Again, it's just the president's personality. To them, he projects this confidence, and they feel like he represents them. He's speaking to them, they don't think he's talking down to them.
Scott, this story is called "Going Home." And it's the third in a series that the Inquirer is doing, in which journalists from USA Today affiliated papers in Ohio will go back to the communities they grew up in. So this is the part of town you're from. So can you just give us a little bit of your experience of what this project was like for you to go back in this context, not just to visit, but to find something to write about?
It was one of the more uncomfortable assignments that I've had in my career. This is the first time I've actually ever written in the first person. And I'm used to, you know, putting other people's names and stories out there, but not my own. And, you know, it kind of makes you feel a little vulnerable because it's not, you know, you don't know how people are going to react. You don't know how people are going to take what you say. And, you know, when, you know, like as the author Thomas Wolfe, when, you know, he wrote his semi-autobiographical novels, his hometown hated him after that. So I certainly didn't want, because I love where I grew up. I'm proud I grew up on the west side of Cincinnati. It's a very friendly community. And as I said in the story, it hasn't really changed that much. I think a lot of it due to the geography. It's set back far from the highway. One thing I hear from outsiders is they always get lost over there because it's, you know, not easy to find your way around. And even I grew up there, and there are places, you know, I still don't, you know how to get to over there. So it's got its rich character over there.
We're talking with Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer. You write that you were spurned by your alma mater. You went to Elder.
Oh, it was brutal. No, it was, I love Elder. It's a great school. They just didn't want to participate in a political story, which is, you know, fair enough. It's, you can get a lot of heat if you say anything political. So they just did not want to participate, unfortunately.
Wouldn't it be nice to have that option on this program sometimes to not talk about anything political? But here we are. And though we are talking about the West Side in the context of its strong support for Trump, there are certainly people on that side of town who are voting for the Democratic side of things this election. What are you seeing as it relates to that kind of change on that side of town?
The West Side is starting up to a point to get a bit more diverse. I mean, historically, it's a middle class neighborhood. It's historically been, you know, almost exclusively, like when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s there, it was almost exclusively white, very little diversity. But you're starting to have younger families moving into some of the neighborhoods over there. It's getting more diverse. You have more immigrant families moving in the certain areas. But like I said, it's up to a point. Once you get to the Cincinnati city limits over there, it's still pretty much very conservative, not as diverse. But when you get to neighborhoods like Price Hill, Westwood, and Cheviot, which is outside the city limits, but it's closer to the city, it's getting more Democratic, more liberal, and there's much more diversity.
And just to revisit what we were talking about, Scott, as it relates to people's guts, whether it be the president's gut or the voters that support him, just based on that gut feeling, you do conclude this story with a conversation with a woman named Linda Shiner, who lives in Green Township. I guess that's part of the town that you grew up in. And she says that she agrees that Trump is not a humanitarian like Jimmy Carter, whom she also admired. She said, quote, "He's kind of like me. We're kind of straightforward." And I just find all that so interesting. The whole story was really well written, Scott. You did a nice job in the first person. And you can read that at Cincinnati.com. Check out Scott Wortman's stories there. We've got more to talk about because you have a whole slew of stories this week. And it's interesting to me that the chairman of the Democratic Party in Ohio had to speak out against the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Kentucky based on an ad Amy McGrath was running. It's complicated to run in Kentucky for a variety of reasons, but just from running ads, you have to advertise in the Cincinnati media market, which means your ad is seen by a lot of people who are not voting for you, regardless of their position about you. And it's also very expensive, and you have to walk this delicate line of appealing to a certain type of Democratic voter that might be different than the national type. What's going on here with this situation?
Well, everyone involved said it was an unusual situation, but basically Amy McGrath running against Mitch McConnell ran this ad, which in and of itself is very unusual for any party, where it features a voter from Paducah, Kentucky, who's a Trump voter. So he's voting for the president of the opposing party, saying that he's voting for Amy McGrath, though, because of Mitch McConnell's trade policies. So it was airing in the Cincinnati market, and David Pepper, the Ohio Democratic Party chair, became aware of this ad. And he's like, hey, look, we're trying to deliver Ohio for Joe Biden, and we don't need any ad that can be perceived as sympathetic to Donald Trump, because it's already going to be close enough as it is. And so he asked the McGrath campaign, hey, can you can run this in Kentucky? I don't care. You got to do what you got to do, but don't run this in Cincinnati. The McGrath campaign got a little defensive about it, saying, hey, this is not pro Donald Trump, you know, and, you know, they didn't say that they pulled it because of David Pepper's ultimatum, but it did stop airing right after that in the Cincinnati area. Now, evidently, it is running elsewhere in the state. But even David Pepper said, I've never had to do this before, but these are unusual circumstances.
And Amy McGrath has faced this issue in a way before, because she had been criticized by some of her opponents, at least supporters of her opponents in the Democratic primary, about whether she's a, quote, pro-Trump Democratic candidate. She had that flip-flop situation where she said she would have voted to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh, then changed her position on that. So these kind of things have dogged her campaign for the past 18 months.
But you said it at the start of this segment. I mean, it's an odd situation in Kentucky because it's a very red state. So it's incredibly difficult in a tightrope, an uphill tightrope, basically, that a Democrat has to walk up if they're running state, particularly against such an established and powerful candidate like Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, and David Pepper is correct, if you look at polls, that Ohio could be in play this year. Kentucky is certainly not in play by most counts as it relates to the presidential election, but Amy McGrath trying to make a move in the U.S. Senate race there, very complicated when you're running in a state that borders what could be a major player in the electoral outcome. Hey, before we let you run, Scott, I know that the Inquirer hosted a debate between the candidates for Ohio 1 congressional district incumbent Republican Steve Chabot and Democratic challenger Kate Schroeder. We got to talk to Kate Schroeder this week. We didn't hear back from Steve Chabot, but did you get to catch this debate? Did anything come of it?
I was there in the studio. I was in the Enquirer newsroom, and Steve Chabot's strategy for and I'm not exactly sure what polling he's seeing or the logic behind it, but his strategy is to try and tie Kate Schroeder into the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. He brought up, I wasn't able to count the total number of times that he referenced this, but he brought up the Green New Deal, which is the economic and environmental reforms proposed by some of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. He brought that up constantly through the debate, trying to tie Kate Schroeder into those type of policies. Now, Kate Schroeder says that she opposes the Green New Deal, saying it's too expensive. But clearly the strategy for Steve Chabot is trying to peg Kate Schroeder as liberal as possible.
Scott Wortman is a reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. He grew up on the west side of town.
Yeah.
And now he lives closer to me, I think, on the other side of the river. So, Scott, stay safe on the other side of the river and good work this week. We'll look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you, Michael.
And joining us now is another friend of the show and another reporter from the Cincinnati Enquirer. We've got Julia Fair, who took a look at COVID-19 violations in Northern Kentucky. She's also on Zoom. Julia, welcome.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. You did this deep dive into some of the complaints that have emerged in Northern Kentucky as it relates to violations of the restrictions put in place during COVID-19. And I was fascinated right off the bat because you open with complaints against police officers. You have this story about a pregnant woman in Boone County who was pulled over for having expired tags. And she wrote in her complaint that this deputy got up in her face, maskless, was well within 6 feet of me. He needlessly put my safety and the health of my pregnancy at risk. And that's not the only complaint against law enforcement.
That's right. There were plenty of complaints in the database that the state compiled about COVID-19 complaints in Northern Kentucky. You know, there were complaints about maskless police officers, crowded stores and warehouses, restaurants that defied physical distancing and mask mandates. Some lost their liquor license over that. But there are also complaints about backyard parties and more. But yes, there were a few complaints about maskless police officers in Northern Kentucky. There's about a handful of them. So we found that, you know, police officers weren't wearing masks while talking to the public. We also found that there really isn't a really protocol for these local police departments in the story for mask mandates for their officers.
It's interesting to talk about law enforcement in this context because, you know, there have been politics surrounding COVID-19 restrictions since the very beginning, but we had seen some law enforcement agencies or individual officers express expressly that they are not in charge of enforcing these bans. Mm-hmm. And like, this is the health department's responsibility. That is true. But mm-hmm. what happens when these are enforced, since we see that law enforcement themselves are possibly in violation on occasion?
Mm-hmm. I was able to speak to Kenton County Police Chief Spike Jones. And he was saying, he tells his officers, just wear your mask when it makes sense. And so he also told me that he understands when an officer would take off a mask if their vision was impaired by the mask or by impaired on their glasses, if their glasses were fogging up. But, you know, he also said, you know, if you are a citizen and you see a maskless officer and you feel like they should have been wearing a mask, give him a call and he'll talk it out with you.
Let's talk about Towns End Bar in Florence, mm-hmm. because this particular bar, I think, got some national attention. It definitely went viral on social media when the owner of that bar had a lot of his fans mm-hmm. out in the parking lot, and they were singing and basically shouting at Bashir. They were not masked. They were very close together, and mm-hmm. They used some profanity that I'm not allowed to say on the radio. I didn't realize that their liquor license ended up being suspended.
Yes. So everybody, I think, remembers the viral video. And so the viral video caused over 40 complaints to be submitted to the state over mask and social distancing violations that were happening in this Florence bar. So the state did suspend the liquor license. The suspension was lifted in September. But that wasn't the only bar that got its license suspended because of their physical distancing violations. There was also a bar in Covington that lost their license too.
And that one's interesting. You're talking about Legends. Mm-hmm. Legends, yes. Bar and Grill, which is a Latonia watering hole, very popular with that community. And it was a shooting investigation,
yes,
that led to the discovery of COVID-19 health violations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so police were investigating a shooting that happened at the bar after it got a little rowdy. And they were looking at video surveillance, and video surveillance showed that no one was wearing a mask, and that an employee was pouring liquor from a bottle directly into somebody's mouth. And the video also showed a lot of maskless employees. And so the state felt like it was enough of a risk that they did suspend that license, the liquor license there.
Okay, so here at the radio station, Julia, mm-hmm. we all have like our different mic screens. So if we come in and out of the studios, we're not allowed to be in the studio together at the same time. We have to switch out our microphones. And mm-hmm. that's because we know that COVID is you know, possibly spread this way. It comes out of our mouths and into the air. And if we're that close to a microphone, it's going to stick to it, which brings me to karaoke.
Yes.
And I mean, it seems like karaoke would be a bad idea, as fun mm-hmm. as it can be after a mm-hmm. couple of drinks. And there was a place in Bromley, a relatively new place that opened in Bromley, Divine Waffles and Weck. They had a karaoke party.
Yes. So they had a karaoke party, and the state sent them a warning saying you can't do karaoke right now. It's not safe. So they did get a warning, but then the restaurant didn't make the adjustments they needed. And so early in September, the state temporarily shut down the restaurant for physical distancing violations. So, yeah, there was another place that had a karaoke party. I can't remember which one it was, but they did make adjustments. And so they didn't get shut down. But, lots of karaoke parties going on in Northern Kentucky, which can't do right now. So,
well, importantly, though, you also mm-hmm. talked about some of the workers, and this had been a concern across the nation. A lot of media outlets were covering how, mm-hmm. Meat packers and other warehouse type workers were dealing with this. And we certainly have a lot of manufacturing in Northern Kentucky and some warehouses there. So what type of complaints emerged from that situation?
Yeah, so there were a lot of crowded warehouse complaints in this database about Northern Kentucky warehouses. Workers were saying, like, one worker wrote that he watched a coworker spit in his or her hands to get a better grip on shared machinery. But it was also about crowded clock-in lines and crowded lunch tables and, crowded work lines. And so there was one company, Novolex, in Boone County that got a notice from the state saying, hey, you got to fix these things. And so Novolex did fix those. So after they got the notice, the company removed picnic tables outside so employees couldn't sit next to each other. They marked social distancing spaces. They also installed plexiglass dividers in the break room. And now employees have reminders about social distancing and mask wear use on their paychecks, newsletters, and posters throughout the warehouse.
You can read more of this report from Julia Fair at Cincinnati.com. And Julie, before we let you run, I think we had you on recently to talk about this development at the former Beverly Hills Supper Club site in Southgate. And this development got the okay after some controversy to go forward. But now a judge is involved and this major development is stopped for now.
So, yes, this is the former site of the Beverly Hills Supper Club. It's also where a major fire killed over 100 people in the 1970s. And so construction is temporarily stopped on just a portion of the $65 million mixed-use development that's poised to transform that former site. So construction is temporarily stopped on 1 to 2 acres, but the entire project is on 77 acres. And it stopped on that small portion because some descendants of fire victims are asking a judge, hey, like, should this be considered a burial ground? Their loved ones died there. And they think it should. And in Kentucky, if it's a burial ground, you can't build on it.
But it so, also, suggests, I mean, do they mm-hmm. believe that there are bodies there?
That's right. One of the descendants at a public meeting said that one of her mother's body parts were still up there, and that she didn't get all of it back after the tragic fire. So they are making the argument that there are still body parts up there. The developers have said that all of the body parts have been removed, and they have also said, you know, if we find any while we're doing construction, we'll stop construction until those body parts could be properly interned. But for now, there's no construction on those 1 to 2 acres.
You can read more about this at cincinnati.com. Julia Fair, thank you so much for the time you gave us. I'll look forward to a karaoke duet with you as soon as the restrictions are lifted. Thanks for the time you gave us.
Oh, you're on. Sounds good.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Sometimes he's handsome, sometimes he's beautiful. That's Kit Russell, the most glamorous man in the world. That was a profile of Kit Russell in Whisper magazine. Kit Russell was a man at the heart of a long-told story here in Cincinnati, and writer and historian Greg Hand revisited it for Cincinnati Magazine. He joins us now via Zoom to talk about it. Greg, welcome back to our show.
Always a pleasure.
Indeed it is. The true story of UC's male homecoming queen. I'm looking at this picture of Kit Russell. He really was handsome, and he really was beautiful, depending on how he was presenting. But give us this story. I asked about it a little bit, and people had heard of this. I had not.
Yeah, the when I started working at UC, I worked for several years with actually a Cincinnati broadcast legend, a guy named George Bryant, who at one time was general manager of WGUC and had a number of roles in radio and television. And George's role at the university was to develop these slideshows that they would take around, kind of fundraising sort of activities, things about different aspects of the history of the university. And he mentioned this story about the veterans returning to the University of Cincinnati in the late 1940s, and how there were so many, they built Vetsville by filling the quadrangles with Army surplus barracks. And the veterans and their families moved in there, and there were so many veterans, according to this slideshow, that one of them ran for homecoming queen and was elected winner, elected the homecoming queen. And it was one of those things where George did marvelous work on these shows, and his voice is still remembered very fondly. But he didn't document a lot of the stuff that he reported in these shows. And so while I was at UC, I kept trying to find out, who was this homecoming queen? And the obvious places to look, the yearbook, the student newspaper, that sort of thing, just didn't include any information about anything unusual in any of the late 1940s homecoming court situations, electing the king and the queen. And it took years after I retired before I accidentally came across an incident in which the UC veterans decided to elect a queen. And the queen was a veteran, not a student. It was not at homecoming. And the queen for the veterans' sweetheart dance in February of 1947 was, in fact, Kit Russell.
Amazing.
As you indicated.
It's amazing because Kit Russell performed a lot. And we'll note Kit Russell was born Russell Paul, died at the age of 70 back in 1994 in South Carolina. But Kit Russell was known around town, performed in a lot of clubs. And what's fascinating to me is that you include this advertisement in the Inquirer from January of 1947. It's promoting Cincy's biggest little nightclub, the Bandbox, featuring the Gay Boy Review. And I'm thinking, this is 1947. I can't even find a Gay Boy Review now. I mean, what exactly were the circumstances that some type of performance like this could be going on?
You know, the thing is, it was not uncommon to have drag acts performing in Cincinnati during the right up until into the 1950s, 1960s. It kind of tails off after that. But drag performances started in Cincinnati during the 1870s. There was a particular performer named Roselle, who did a lot of appearances in the Over the Rhine area in the 1870s, 1880s. The major Cincinnati theaters hosted nationally known female impersonators throughout the 1890s into the 1920s. And then you start seeing, after Prohibition, a lot of, they were billed as female impersonators. Today we'd call them drag acts, in nightclubs around Cincinnati. And this is everywhere in Cincinnati, the northern Kentucky. The one example I have is my old neighborhood of Dent. The Twin Lanterns had the Gay Boys Review. And on almost any weekend, you could probably find a drag act in Cincinnati from the 1930s into the 1950s.
Fascinating. It was fascinating to read that this act performed in Fort Mitchell. My Northern Kentucky people will understand why that's a little strange, but I love this story. It can be read at CincinnatiMagazine.com or at Greg Hand's Cincinnati Curiosities, an outstanding blog with daily updates of curiosities from this town. It's really well done. Before we let you run, though, Greg, can you tell us a little bit about this old theater here in town? Just share a little story about the Imperial Follies Theater and why it was busted up by the Cincinnati Vice Squad back in 1963.
I received an invitation from the current owner of the Imperial Theater to take a tour of the building, which is absolutely fascinating. And I believe they are raising funds to renovate this building. It's in the Mohawk area. It's right at the intersection of McMicken and Mohawk. And the owner had a number of questions about the history of the building, so I started digging into it. And it turned out that the Imperial Theater played a role in freedom of expression in the United States. There was a film showing in 1963 that was busted by the Vice Squad at the insistence of a guy named Charles Keating, who later served prison time for his role in the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s. But he wanted the Vice Squad to come in and rule that the films they were showing were obscene. And one of the films was the focus of the lawsuit. The theater lost in Cincinnati. There was an appeal. The appeal went all the way to the Supreme Court, which heard the case in 1968, so about 5 years after the original bust. And a year prior to the Supreme Court hearing this Cincinnati case, they had made a ruling in New York that community standards were absolutely essential in determining whether something was obscene or not, and that community standards had not been consulted in making this bust in Cincinnati. And so they threw the case out. Now, the New York case focused strictly on printed material, literature. And the ruling the next year, 1968, on this film spread that concept of community standards to film and other media. So it was a very important landmark case.
It's a curious city we've got here, Greg Hand. You do such a great job profiling. I encourage you people to Google Cincinnati Curiosities and find more from Greg Hand. Greg, there was a story we thought we'd talk about today we didn't get to. I'm going to have you back before Halloween, though, if you have the time. And we're going to talk about this local drive-in theater and something scary and fun that was going on there. Greg, always a pleasure. Thanks for spending some Friday with us.
Absolutely. Take care.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.